Today's episode of the Film Stage Roundtable is brought to you by MUBI. For your free 30-day trial of MUBI, all you gotta do is go to MUBI.com/filmstage.
Try to see it my way. Do I have to keep on talking till I can go on? While you see it your way, run the risk of knowing that our love may soon be gone. We can work it out. We can work it out.
Back, ladies and gentlemen, to a brand new episode of the Film Stage Roundtable. This is the spin-off podcast of the Film Stage's movie review podcast, Film Stage Show. On these episodes, rather than review a movie, we talk about things that are happening in the cinematic sphere in general. Today, we have a single topic, which will pretty much be stretched out over the entirety of the program, so we hope you enjoy that. Before we get into that, though, let me introduce everyone. I, of course, am your host, Brian J. Rowan, and with me today we have Michael Snydell.
Hello.
And Bill Graham.
Ho, 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 ho.
Yes. And, yeah, you can follow us on Twitter, at Film Stage Show, Facebook, The Film Stage Show. Find us on iTunes, give us a comment and a rating, and let us know how we're doing. You can email us, podcast@thefilmstage.com. And if you are one of our brand spanking new patrons who's keeping us going through Patreon, you can, of course, speak to us in the special Patreon-exclusive Slack channel that we have. That is correct, ladies and gentlemen. We are on Patreon now, soliciting donations. For as little as $1 an episode, you can become one of the few, the proud, the patrons of the Film Stage Show. What does this get you, the listener at home? For one, like I said, you get access to a special Slack channel where you can talk to all of us in real time and tell us exactly how great or how wrong we are whenever you feel like it, opening ourselves up to all kinds of abuses at your hands, and we are looking forward to it immensely. Not only that, but you become entered into special raffles that only apply to our patrons this week. If you are one of the first people to give to our Patreon page, you'll be entered into a raffle to win a Blu-ray copy of Francis Ford Coppola's Rumblefish. And this isn't any old copy of Rumblefish. This is a copy that is currently owned privately by our benevolent Lord and Master, Jordan Raup. That's right. Our editor-in-chief is putting his own Blu-ray Criterion collection up on the block to help us and to help you to join our Patreon page. So if you'd like to win Jordan Raup's Blu-ray Criterion copy of Rumblefish, and who wouldn't? Let's be real. All you have to do is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and sign up to give as little as $1 an episode. Not only that, but the more that we make, the more other cool stuff we're going to do for you. So for instance, once we hit our first goal of $50 an episode, we will start recording a monthly classic film podcast. So we'll talk about, Casablanca, The Maltese Falcon, stuff that doesn't star Humphrey Bogart too, probably, after we've gotten through all the stuff that stars Humphrey Bogart. And that those episodes will not be something that you will be charged for. So don't worry that like every new episode that we do is going to be more money out of your pocket. Nope, nope. Those are just special things we're going to do because you love us so much and we want to love you in return. So again, all you got to do is go to patreon.com/thefilmstageshow and give from your heart into our pockets so that we can, in some small way, create a better show for you with both more content and hopefully more technical acumen. patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. That is that for that particular thing. We are also still brought to you by MUBI. Anyone who's been listening to us knows how much we love MUBI. MUBI is the streaming online service that brings you a brand new, foreign, independent, or all-around wonderful piece of film every day that you then have 30 days to watch. So you have a constantly rotating selection of 30 hand-picked films to which to choose from. These are films that can be viewed on your mobile device, your computer, or select smart TVs and smart TV devices. I, for instance, use the Roku app, which is beautiful, as is their iPhone app. And on your mobile devices, you can actually download the movies directly to your phone. I am still, to this day, still dealing with the after effects of a sunburn that I got last Sunday. And if only I had stayed inside and watched more movie films, I wouldn't have had to deal with it. And that's why we have our new tagline, Mubi, better than sunscreen. Woo. So all you got to do to get your free 30-day trial of Mubi is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you will get a free 30-day trial on us. Again, it is mubi.com/filmstage. All right, that's all we've got for housekeeping plugs and various things like that for now. So, gentlemen, how about we actually jump into our first discussion topic?
And only.
It's in parts. So, the New York Times released a list that swept through film culture. It is titled The 25 Best Films of the 21st Century So Far. Now, anytime that we at the Film Stage create a list, we come onto this podcast to dissect the shit out of that list. So how could we ignore the gray lady doing the same? So here we are. We've got this list, the 25 best films of the 21st century so far. And we're going to talk about them. We're going to give our thoughts on the list itself and what it says about stuff. And then we're going to do our classic remove one and replace it. So we're going to choose a film to take off of the list, and then we're going to replace it with another film that we feel should have been on the list. Before we begin, Bill Graham, you have some prepared remarks.
Yes. I just want to mention real quick, at the start of this list, it mentions kind of their aim and their goal. And I want you all to keep in mind this as you both read the top 25 films that they settled on, and also read what or listen to what we say about the list overall and things like that. But the paragraph or the sentence begins, as the chief film critics of the Times, we decided to rank, with some help from cinema savants on Facebook, haha, very funny, the top 25 movies that are destined to be the classics of the future. So I want you to keep that in mind, the classics of the future. That's their goal here, in their own words, to make a list of the classics of the future. So, yeah.
Is that not the goal of every list?
No, because the best films of the 21st century so far wouldn't necessarily be the classics, wouldn't necessarily be the ones that are repeat watchers and the ones that are kind of called upon in the future to kind of reflect upon this time in the 21st century and stuff like that, right? So, you know, there's always a difference between favorite and best, right? And there's a lot of debate about which – how much that kind of plays into it. But I think classics
– there's a weight to that word.
There is a huge weight to it, and what it means is,
if you're putting anything on your top 10 that you don't believe is going to be a future classic, then you're not really being true to the spirit of the list.
No, because if you say this film is going to be a future classic, but 10 people watched it, it's not going to be a future classic. I just hate to break it to you.
Provably false.
Well, yeah, I don't know if that's not the sense, but I think that there is something to be said that, like, classic can also mean influence. Like, I'm sure all of us can point to certain movies that we don't personally love, but we know it's a great movie. We know it is something that will stand the test of time. So, like, I mean, speaking a little bit to what Bill is talking about, this is – that opening paragraph is a little bit strange when considering the entire format is almost more like they're trying to, like, define the ethos of the century. Like, a number of entries on this list feel like they're trying to, like, be the pioneers of a trend or, like, express something larger about a period of time more than, like, stand on their own, which is interesting. But again, as Bill says, that opening paragraph certainly is like an odd intent of purpose.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I think, first of all, it's 2017. It's a weird time to be releasing one of these lists.
Certainly.
Like, to be fair, I know you could technically do one of these like every month, of every year.
Sure.
Until the literal end of the 21st century. But it's like 2015, sure. 2020, definitely.
You have a better argument, for instance, when Sight and Sound comes out with a list every 10 years.
Right.
Than when, like, the last one that people were talking about was the BBC list from August of last year. Like, we are doing this a lot, but, you know, it is... I shouldn't say only, but it is definitely that it's the New York Times, you know, someone who reputation.
The New York Times, yeah, the New York Times, when you say that, it has a reputation,
sure.
Right? And so this is the premier newspaper in all the land in many respects. And, you know, hubbed out of New York City, right? One of the major metropolitan cities, one of two locations where Oscar qualifications actually occur, right? So yeah, they're kind of seen as the hotbed. Sure. as if you are a New York Times film critic, you are somebody. People more than likely recognize and know your name.
Yes. But this is – I suggested this topic because, you know, it's always fun to argue lists even though it drives some people crazy. But in general, I do find like the quality of how you even define a list almost as interesting as the actual list. Like,
right. Well, I mean, for my end of year list, I always say my favorites of the year.
You know? Sure.
Like if I ever say best, I like – really play up how ridiculous that is, because saying the best films is something that's hard to,
sure.
to do anyway. It's like, what are the best paintings of the Renaissance? And it's like, well, you know, fucking 10 people in a room will give you 10 different answers. Like,
yeah,
the best,
like there's movies we have like nostalgic blindness for, but then yeah. There's also things that you just like more than other people,
like Top Gun, favorite movie, best movie, probably not.
Sure.
I'm not going to say it's not, but it's probably not. But like movies and art in general, they're things that like even if you can track like box office or cultural impact in whatever way we want that to be measured, you know, it's not the same. It's not the same. It's not, you know, the yep. best baseball player of all time. You can look at stats and quantify who that is. Probably be better if you pick a position, but who knows. So anyway, so that's where we are. We've got this list, and just in general, like looking at the list, like did this seem like a good list to you guys? Like when you were reading this, did you say I agree with many to some of these choices?
I really like this list, actually. I haven't seen 10 of the films on it, but I think that the ones that they pick, I like that they kind of head off criticism. Like the obvious things I can jump to is the Clint. So at third place on this list is Million Dollar Baby, which is a movie that has a very divisive critical reputation.
Spoiler
and even Clint Eastwood
comments from me.
And even Clint Eastwood is someone who among some people think he's one of the best filmmakers of the century. I've heard people, you know, who are especially like
yeah,
more.
But I've also heard that Michael Bay is one of our premier filmmakers as well.
There's a huge difference between Clint Eastwood.
I know.
No, I mean I understand what you're saying, but I'm just. I guess my point in saying that is that I think that this is a little more savvy than what you'd expect with a list like this, because they are, you know, it's very earnest in a way that doesn't feel trolly, and it's kind of refreshing that even, you know, when they come to choices from Spielberg or Clint Eastwood or, you know, any of these, you know, major filmmakers, even if they went with something a little off the beaten path, they do, you know, bring up the other obvious things, and I do think they justify their own choices. And as far as like the more outre choices, there's like a number of things I've heard of on here that I've wanted to check out, but I haven't. And I think that again, some of those like represent a trend as much as like the individual film. Like you have something like Edward Yang's Yi Yi, or
which is on both lists, by the way.
or Gia Zanki and their Anyways, Yang is part of like this new Taiwan cinema. So it's like, one sec, guys.
This is just, Michael ordered food that did not arrive before we began recording, and I suppose this means it has just arrived.
Thank you so much. Wow, someone wrote that cars is the most fun. Oh, Jesus. Sorry.
The most fun of anything,
like the most fun of the Pixar movies.
It's the one that probably involves the least amount of crying. So like, there's that, you know.
Are we on Inside Out now?
No, we're on. Yeah. Hey, what did you get?
I got a soft crab poi boy.
Oh, did you get enough to share?
Stuff
it right through that mic.
It's a little difficult as far as delivery methods,
though. You just fax it. You just, like, right? You fax the sandwich?
Yeah, take a picture of it and then fax it over to us.
Put it on Instagram.
There you go. Put a nice filter on it. Yeah. Don't forget the
filter. Give it the Mayfair. So anyway, okay. You were in the middle of speaking.
Yeah, I'm sorry, though. I will stop, like, making grand pronouncements. The last thing I'll say is, though, like, even the ones that are a little more off the beaten path, like, you know, I have heard Yi, for instance, you know, praised as one of the best films of the century earlier, but like a number of these seem like they're trying to stand in for larger movements as well, or as much as like being its own singular choice, which is, again, you know, maybe that's problematic in itself, like as far as like list making, that these movies don't necessarily, there are a lot of like easy omissions you could bring in, whether you're talking about art house cinema or blockbuster cinema. Like, mm-hmm. You know, I'm sure we could rattle off 20 to 30 each, but like, I do think that there's something, just kind of unique to this list, even though it's also kind of baffling at times in terms of who they have, you know, in terms of the conversations or the people they chose to bring in their thoughts on some of these.
Or like even which movie from which creator within this century.
Absolutely.
You know, like there's a lot of that, like, especially, you know, if they're trying to find like future classics, you know, who are going to be a reflection of time.
Which is exactly my point about that kind of opening or that last sentence right before they jump into the list is I'm focusing here on they're trying to choose the classics of the future. And I think they were just a hair left or just a hair right to what should have been, in my estimation, is going to be the reflection, you know, the one that people bring up the most as far as the classics from these particular directors. I think we can go ahead and write it off as safe that There Will Be Blood is absolutely a lock for this list.
Sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But there's somebody said as well that this doesn't have the same things as a lot of lists that came out.
Probably come up when I'm talking, because I have some questions. Okay. Well, it's, you know, I could just run through a list of like non-represented directors that just seem like, you know, these are people operating at the height of their power, and yet they're not included, and they have movies that are not just good, but reflect the times in which they were made. Even, you know, like I'd already said, some directors on this list have movies that I think would be better suited for this list. But, you know, to begin, we're going to just do our remove one, add one. And then if we have time left over, we can each run through a couple of other bafflements or additions that we think are interesting and worth talking about.
Well, just, Brian, just to pause before this, do you guys think, I know we just said that you could do a list of this every 6 months, and it sometimes seems like there is one that comes out every 6 months. Do you think there is purpose to this list right now?
No. I literally, like, when I saw this getting passed around, I literally said, why now?
Mm.
Like, what is the, why, like, it's not even like, before Cannes begins, or like on the heels of the Oscars. It's like
there's no news peg.
Right. There's like it's like someone really fucked up their SEO search engine optimization and was like, this is the time for this list. And someone was like, why? And they're like, because there's nothing else going on. And it's like, no, that's not how it works anymore, bro. Like, you don't fill a slow news day with news. You have to wait until something hits that you can like drag in the slipstream of.
No, I think the way that they, Michael, I think you kind of touched on it. I think the way that they went about this, the fact that they are kind of having a conversation about each of these films, the way that they wrapped in whether it's directors or actors to kind of give commentary on these individual films and the picks and the selections, the fact that they kind of have all this Facebook commentary going on the sidebar, I think the way they did it made it a news item. I don't think the list itself is a news item. I think the way they went about it, the commentary they added to each of these films and things like that, I think that works. So, yeah, I think the way they went about it was newsworthy in a way. So it became something that you can reflect upon in a couple of years and still look back on. It's not going to be a list that's just completely out of date because, you know, it's a year old or 2 years old or 5 years old or whatever. So,
sure. Yeah.
All right. Okay. So are we ready? So this is how it's going to go. We're going to do a round robin style, like always. We're going to subtract one each of us, and then we're going to add one each of us. And then, like I said, if we have enough time after that, we can talk about some more of the oddities of this list and things that we just were confused about. So, Bill Graham, you got to kick us off with your little postscript. So, Michael Snydell, why don't you kick us off with talking about what one of these films... Oh, by the way, I guess we should say to everyone, like, I'm going to post the link for this list in the notes for this episode. So if you have no idea what we're talking about, that's where the list is found. I also tweeted it out. It is on Twitter under the Film Stage Show.
Do we want to just run through 1 through 25?
Literally,
real quick?
No. Absolutely fucking okay. Not. Michael Snydell, which of these movies would you like to remove?
Oh, God. See, this is where it gets difficult, as I talked about a little.
Come on, Mike.
Fuck. All right. When it comes to removing things, it's preference. You know what? Since I'm first, I'm going to take the easy one. And you know what? Fuck it. I'm getting rid of Boyhood. I'm going to be an asshole.
What?
Whoa, what a dick.
Oh, man.
This from Michael, Have You No Love in Your Heart, Snydell.
God.
I'm the two hour guy.
Wait, Bill, something got said that we need to address. Did you just say you liked Birdman more than Boyhood?
No, Bernie. No, oh. Okay. Birdman, get out of here.
All right.
No, I'm partly trolling. I really respect Boyhood as a technical achievement. I think what it does following, you know, what is it? Is it eight or? Is it a decade or is it 8 years?
It's
12 successive years. I'm sorry. Yes. I think it's an interesting experiment. I literally forgot Boyhood as I was walking out of the theater. I'm sorry. God. I know that's going to get some hate here.
Yeah,
I'm actually
a
big Linklater fan in general, but that one doesn't do that much for me. And since I'm first,
I think
I could take Brian's, but I'm not going to because I'm pretty sure I know what Brian's is.
Who, but, you know, I've been real subtle about it so far.
But I'm going to do, you know, I don't, this list has a few docs. It has In Jackson Heights, which was one of my favorite movies of last year. And there is The Gleaners and I, Agnes Varda's documentary. And I believe one more. I don't have the whole list in front of me at the moment.
It's hard to have the whole list in front of you. It's got that new media thing where there's a bunch of giant GIFs.
But I'm going to add another doc that I get that is talked about a little bit less, but is, I think,
Adding them already?
Yeah, I'm adding one.
We're not adding them yet. We're taking them away, and then we're going around again, and we're adding them.
Sorry, oh. Sorry.
Literally, I just explained that, Michael.
I didn't understand that either. I'm not eating right now.
I'm not Bill. Jeez.
So that's it. It's just it's a boring Linklater movie. That's your one reason for.
Honestly, guys, I mean there are head scratchers on here. There's, you know, Munich is the Steven Spielberg choice. There is Million Dollar Baby. If I wanted to go the art house direction, there's Ellen Font, which is a lesser in my mind Dardenne brothers.
I believe movie it's pronounced L'Enfant.
L'Enfant, which I actually just watched this weekend and is interesting, but also feels very much like an echo of their 90s masterpiece La Promesse. So I feel like that's a really weird choice, especially when 2 days, one night, Kid with a Bike, mm-hmm. Rosetta, like all of those have been more critically praised and written about. So that was an odd choice. But Boyhood is just, it's something that it would just be so obligatory for me to include it on things. It's something, again, where the technical achievement is the only thing that movie has for me, other than the just unimpeachable charms of Ethan Hawke.
Eller Coltrane.
No, I think Eller Coltrane is fine.
Patricia Arquette.
Yeah, I mean, I love Patricia Arquette, but she's been in other – there's other things I would say she's been better in this century. I love her in Lost Highway. She's amazing in that.
That's not in this century, though.
Yes, it is. Oh, shit. Is that 90 – ah, that's 97. God damn it.
Michael doesn't even know when space and time is happening. All right, well –
we could bring up that the century doesn't start until 2001, which I've seen – bring
I
up
was curious about that, because part of me wanted to be like, why is an American Psycho on there? But then I was afraid some asshole was going to be like, it's 2000, the century really started in 2001, so I just didn't say anything. Bill Graham, yeah, it's your turn. What film from this list would you remove?
Okay, this one's going to be easy for me because I assume that you're going to choose one, and I'm pretty sure already about it. So I'm just going to go ahead and choose 40-Year-Old Virgin. That pick is completely and utterly baffling to me. There are so many other high-quality comedies out there to choose from that you're just going to stick one in there, and it happens to be the kicker offer of Steve Carell's kind of career in many ways.
And Judd Apatow. It's,
I guess.
And Seth Rogen.
I mean,
I'm going like, to, I deeply disagree with this choice.
You disagree.
If we're going with the theme of this list, I kind of agree with Brian.
Yeah. I think that given what they say that it belongs on this list, but Bill, please continue with your explication as to why you would want it removed.
Yeah, because I just don't feel like this is the high quality comedy that we could choose. This is not going to be the classic that more people are going to kind of reflect upon. I think this is lesser of what even Apatow has given us. I think obviously Knocked Up is one of those films that, you know, kind of comes immediately to mind when we think of Apatow, if not some of the others, like Forgetting Sarah Marshall and things like that. I know that isn't directed by him, but, you know, it's under the Apatow. Yeah, and Bridesmaid is the other one that I was kind of thinking of as well. Hell, you know, The Hangover, things like that. I mean, there's so many other utter classic comedies that I immediately think of, and 40-Year-Old Virgin is maybe 10th, 12th, 14th on that list. I think of so many other iconic moments, so many other iconic roles in this century so far that I would just laugh at. Even some of the Coen brothers films I could put on here as a replacement for their one dull pick as a comedy, because they had to have a comedy, I guess, a straight comedy in many ways. I'm just completely baffled by this pick. I think the fact that it kickstarted all of these people's careers is a bunch of bullshit. Like, I don't care that that's what happened. That doesn't mean anything to me. What I care about is what is the classic nature of it. And I think to see their kickstart isn't necessarily to see them at their peak. And I want to see them at their peak. I don't want to see them at their start. Right. So I think that particular pick is just baffling. So
I hear what you're saying, but I disagree firmly.
Okay.
You know, just given based on what you said, like, given the careers that were launched and the style of comedy filmmaking that it created, like, this truly is a comedy classic already.
And the only other one I would say is close would be McKay, like either the Step Brothers or Anchorman, but that is even after, and that is absolutely, you know, piggybacking on. And
McKay doesn't really have the heart of Apatow, the giant lumbering,
shaggy, gets
poorly
in and
edited
out.
Heart of Judd Apatow.
All right, you said what I was going to say. I said he gets in and out.
Yes, that is true. McKay is a lightning bolt, and Apatow is like a drunk elephant. So I had some choices here. I'll run you through a couple of the ones that I was sort of thinking of taking out. Just to build up to the one I was thinking of. Because everyone's
can't do that. This is not anything that any of us have done so far, and you're going to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
No, Brian, do one and we'll come back. Let's come back.
It's fairly obvious by now. I'm choosing Million Dollar Baby.
Yes.
Because, again, going purely by future classic, this film, I feel, has already failed that metric. Like, it's already something that if I were to say it to someone would be like, oh yeah, that came out. That was a thing.
Yep.
Like, a lot of people won awards for that. And there was a It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia parody about it.
Yeah. And it feels very classical.
Yeah.
it is that type of movie that would have come out in, you know, the 60s or 70s that would have been star studded, but would have been just kind of soggily paced and
And it's funny because it kind of kicked off this weird semi resurgence of boxing movies that we're still in. Because he had, what was it, Southpaw Warrior? And Bleed
the Fighter.
Fighter. And then Creed, which is fantastic. And honestly, could have, if you need a boxing movie on this,
Creed would have been a cool addition to this list.
It would have been a great addition.
I firmly believe that Creed is and will be and can persist as a classic. It's like the Rocky for the new age. I think that
the
filmmaking
style and everything like that.
Yeah.
And aligns with the list.
it definitely aligns with the list. Whereas Million Dollar Baby, 25 best films of the 21st century, why are you going to pick something so...
Sure.
90s? So staid and just kind of... You know, even if you wanted to pick a Clint Eastwood film, for God's sakes, go with Gran Torino. Go with something that was more of a reflection of the world and, something that was already talking about, the dying of baby boomers and the end of this kind of virulent racism just through natural selection. Why go for Million Dollar Baby?
American Sniper is more resonant than Million Dollar Baby. Seriously. Yeah,
it is.
Yeah. I would agree.
Or solely as a non joke, as a everyday hero, I think Sully is a really interesting reflection on our changing views towards heroism.
I agree. And so it struck me as very weird. I saw Million Dollar Baby and I was was this list made in 2004?
Yeah.
How much other things did they have to sift through before they remembered Million Dollar Baby?
And this is high on the list, isn't it?
Yeah, it's number
it's number three.
Oh, Jesus.
It baffles me, and that's why I want to take it off, because there's some movies on here where I'm that's perhaps not the best example of that particular style of filmmaking, where those filmmakers have made something that I thought was more resonant before. And then I get you get to Million Dollar Baby and you're just why even is this on here?
Yeah.
And like, it's not a bad movie. It's sure. It's not, but at the same time, like, this new classics concept they've come up with, it just doesn't make any sense to me. It's
I'm kind of curious to revisit it, honestly, after they said this. I'm not expecting that I, you know, misunderstood it or anything, but I am curious what they saw. And they call it efficient.
Which to me is like crazy. Though it does have Margot Martindale in it, I believe. So, but like, she's like her shitty mother, I think. So, but like, yeah, I just like sat there staring at this list and I was like, we've already gotten to Million Dollar Baby. Like, this is number three. Like, what the hell else can be on this list?
Sure.
And then immediately, like, A Touch of Sin comes up, and I'm like, well, okay, that's a weird fluke, Million Dollar Baby, but I guess I'll keep with this list. And the rest of it is fairly strong. Though, like I said, there are others that I could have chosen. But, like, yeah, just, like, it's a cliche. It's, like, a really easy one, but it's so slap you in the face necessary that I just had to go with Million Dollar Baby. So now let us add our movies to the list. Michael Snydell, you tried to do this previously. Why don't you give it another crack? What would you add to this list?
As I was saying last time, my little prelude was that there's not that many docs on the list. I think there's three, Gleaners and I, Inside Jackson Heights, Frederick Wiseman's fantastic, like, comprehensive look at a New York suburb. And I want to add a third doc that I think kind of in the vein of this list is a good reflection of documentaries' increasing interest in self-reflexiveness. And that is The Arbor by Cleo Bernard, which is a movie that I haven't heard that much about. I'd certainly heard it from critics, so I can understand if it's a little off the beaten path. And I don't want to say too much about it because part of the conceit is what makes The Arbor so interesting. But it combines – it is a documentary about a playwright named Andrea Dunbar. And it combines fiction elements, various perspective changes, theater techniques, and just like all of these formal techniques that communicate – a variety of things about like how permeable identity is and how, you know, as much as, you know, Brian really disliked things like Kate Plays Christine or, you know, or you could point to other things like Exit Through the Gift Shop or The Imposter. Like there's been a series of films that like, you know, harken back to things like F for Fake. And movies that are constantly like questioning their own formats and how they're presenting or I should say are constantly aware of the filter that they are putting a story through. And The Arbor is almost unclassifiable and fantastic in that sense. And yeah, just utterly one of the most like exhilarating movies I've seen this entire century. I think it's on Netflix. That's where I saw it years ago, but I would absolutely recommend it.
Well, I have not seen The Arbor, so I think you might add to this.
I think you might like it. And I say that even as I know you hated Kate Plays Christine,
but I did like F for Fake and Imposter. So who knows?
I would say it's more in the line of that.
Okay. Well, that's good. Bill Graham. What movie would you like to add to this list?
Okay. So I had to go through and figure out something, a way in here. And what I tried to do was I tried to pick something, that was a little bit more populist because that's just kind of my personal bent. I think there's a beauty to something that is both – able to be sold to mass audiences and also be critically well received. I think there's a very fine line that people have to tread there. And I think, you know, when we reflect upon the classics of the future, I think something that made a big splash has to be on here. I think more than likely Mad Max Fury Road is probably the most populous film on this list so far. So I wanted to add one more. And maybe I wanted Inside to add Out. One. Yeah, maybe Inside Out as well. I think you're probably right there. Inside Out probably made more money than Mad Max Fury Road. Because Mad Max Fury Road, as much critical praise and as much commercial praise as it kind of gets, it didn't actually make all that much money worldwide. Plus, I think it made less than $500 million. So
plus Inside Out probably just like in general will always reach a wider audience due to its
just standard. Printed money.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So I wanted to choose something that was a little less obvious than something that I'll mention later on, because I don't want to mention it now. But this time around, I'm going to choose something that kind of in a way really led the kickstart or the reboot culture and led the reimagining of heroes, the reimagining of the big iconic cinema pieces. It's Casino Royale. And I'm choosing this one, unfortunately, because I immediately reflect on Martin Campbell as a director, and I'm like, well, fine, I guess. But this film is such an aberration in many ways. He's made some other really good films. He did make GoldenEye. He did make, I think, The Mask of Zorro.
Rocketeer.
He's made some other high-quality films. But this one really, to me, really stands out, because what it did was it took a classic person from cinema culture, from cinema history, the James Bond mythos, and it reimagined it. This came out 2 years before another film that a lot of people will kind of point out and say, well, but this is 2 years before that. So this one really kind of in many ways kickstarted the whole idea, the whole notion that there is something to be mined out of something that maybe is decades, you know, decades upon decades old, something that happened in the 80s. Maybe there's something to mine out of it. This film, what it did was it reimagined the James Bond mythos. It gave us a new James Bond, but it also really dug into his personal history and his background, and it gave us a reason to care for him as more than just a playboy that, you know, shoots people really well. This film also gave us Ava Green on the big screen. It gave us Daniel Craig. It also happened to announce why can't I remember his name from Hannibal. As a mighty screen presence.
Mads Mikkelsen?
Yeah, Mads Mikkelsen, who is fantastic in this film. He literally bleeds out of his eye. It's like he's remarkable in this film. The action scenes are fantastic. The opening parkour scene, which of course has to be mentioned because parkour and a lot of this kind of frenetic filmmaking is now kind of the du jour of action cinema in many ways. This film just has everything that I kind of want out of a big blockbuster action film that also has heart at its soul, that also spends enough time creating and developing a character that then we will push forward into kind of lesser fare and lesser movies and maybe lesser story arcs and things like that. But this is the one that plants the seed that gets us interested. It's also the one that really kind of kickstarted, in my view, the whole notion of the reboot culture. And it was finally one of those breakthroughs where critics and theatrical kind of came together and was like, hey, this is really good. This is a high benchmark for me. So, yeah.
I can see that.
Yeah, I like that choice a lot.
Yeah, you make an exceedingly strong case for that in a lot of ways that are very germane to this list.
Thank you.
I'm gonna do something fun. Would anyone like to guess what movie?
I know.
I'm gonna add Michael Snydel.
Well, I don't even know. Hold on, because I can't, because I haven't seen you rant about this on Twitter or anything. So, can I guess that it is a Christopher Nolan film?
I mean, you can.
Then I will.
Okay. Michael Snydel, what do you think?
If it's not the one I thought, I'm going to be really mad because I should have fucking said it. I think it's Such a Beautiful Day.
Okay, see, that's an interesting choice, and it would totally be it, but I didn't know if shorts were allowed on this list.
I mean, an hour and 2 minutes.
Yeah, I guess that counts. What's funny is, so like, I... Okay,
fuck,
first
I should have said it then.
First of all, you're all wrong.
Okay. Yay.
But yeah. I was kind of right. Come on.
You were sort of right, because I was like,
how do you know
what?
You were kind of right?
You were kind of right
because he would have picked that?
Okay, well, no. I was more in consideration for It's Such a Beautiful Day than anything Christopher Nolan did. Because I love Chris Nolan. Me and Chris, we're homies. I've been with him since the beginning.
Just like Denny V.
Yeah, Denny V, Terry Mal, you know, all those guys. But like, I never really thought of putting...
DV is tops, man. DV is tops.
Yeah, Denny V is bae. I am so
Terry.
Excited you said that.
There's no Terry!
That's... Okay, so... That's it. I'm adding a Terrence Malick film to this list. I was almost certain that someone would guess that, and yet no one did. I was thinking of Hertzfeld because, like, cartoons, and, you know, they should be in there. But more than It's Such a Beautiful Day, I wanted to put World of Tomorrow.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
Yeah, but that's super short. So, again, I don't know if I can do that. So I guess we're just going to have to wait for Hertzfeld to create a single long-form movie.
Okay, so what did you pick?
I picked...
Brian, if you say song to song, I swear to
God.
Okay.
I'm going to go with New World. Okay. So I had some issues because I was like, in my brain, I've been like, you know what? I'm going to let all the other guys go first. And between now and then, I will have decided between Tree of Life, New World, and Knight of Cups. And I didn't. So I just like let my mind go clear and picked the one that I chose. But definitely the New World. And I have a lot of reasons for this. I think it's... Perhaps his most...
Director's cut, then?
I'm going to go theatrical.
Just
for the sake of just not going too nuts. But, you know, like, that's a movie that, like, came up on a lot of best of the decade lists. And I was like, oh, shit, it's happening. Like, people are actually realizing how good of a movie this is. And I think that, like, given the way that not just America, but most of the world is doing its best to, like, strip away the fairy tale nature of its history, and like coming to terms with like the way that imperialism and colonialism changed the world, like that's a movie that it really outdoes itself in that by not making most of those points explicit. It is truly a beautiful lyrical look at the collision between these two worlds and the chance at harmony that was ultimately destroyed by us, the white people. And it views it all in the moment. It doesn't have any cute jokes about like, oh, both of our people will be here forever. It's just a simple, pure, beautiful narrative. And like, you know, Terrence Malick, he's hate him or love him, and I'm sure most people hate him. He is one of the most influential, covertly, and like interesting American filmmakers that we have, and to have him not represented on this list. And I know there are people like, he hasn't been good since Badlands, which is his first film, or Days of Heaven, and like The Thin Red Line is and everything else that follows is like harmonious spinning claptrap. But like, you know, I went to bat hard for Song to Song and Knight of Cups and To the Wonder. And I feel like these are all movies that will in their own time become classics. But I think the one that I really wanted to go to bat for was The New World.
All right.
Yeah.
What is in, if you were following the way that this list works, what would you say? How is this reflective of the 21st century?
Well, I think I just said, you know, the 21st century has been defined of stripping away like the romanticism and the myth of like colonialism. And so showing like the immediate distrust and the violence, you know, basically this is Pocahontas, but you know, not the Disney version. It's as close as you can get to a real retelling than like, you know, actually just someone sitting down and saying, I'm going to fucking do this and do the real retelling. Like, it has more probably emotional truth than any of the others. And it just, it's a look back, you know, like it's a look back on our beginnings and kind of framing it as to where we are now with all of its talk of self-reliance and independence and the collision of these two cultures and just seeing how, like, you know, the colonial thirst for wealth and gold, you know, only had one option, which was to wipe out the people who were here first and who lived not entirely in harmony, but mostly in harmony with nature, if not with each other. It's just, it's an interesting kind of retroactive reworking of the myth of Pocahontas and John Smith and their, oh, they had a romance and they fell in love. And it's like, no, he left her. And then she married a tobacco baron and she died in England. Like, you know, there was a there. I never saw it, but there was an animated Pocahontas 2, like Journey to the Old World or something.
Oh, yeah, I saw that.
Yeah, you know, like, it's real fucked up. And this movie,
Disney's made some weird sequels that have no reason to ever have seen the light of day.
Like The Lion King 1.5 or like 2.0 or whatever it was. I can't remember.
Yeah.
Don't people like 1.5 though?
Do they?
I think is it 1.5 just an extended version of 1?
No,
I thought that's Timon and Pumbaa.
They have a number 2. They have a straight up number 2.
Right, that's but there is a 1.5, isn't it?
Yes.
Okay.
But there's a Timon and Pumbaa like side story.
Yeah,
I think that's 1.5.
I think that is 1.5. And then of course there was Timon and Pumbaa the
series?
Disney series.
Yes,
which I remember being quite funny.
Yeah, I watched that.
The Aladdin series was pretty good too.
Yeah.
Hercules? I can't remember. Anyway, we've gotten off track. That'll be for one of our next roundtables where we'll talk about what movies should be turned into TV shows. So keep your radio dial tuned right here to hear that.
Yeah.
So that's it.
So if you were going to rank this, where would New World go on your list?
Oh, I don't know. Probably number one. Like, let's like I'm that much of a Malick fanboy. Actually. Yeah. You know, There Will Be Blood is such a solid choice for number one in terms of, like, what it says about us and everything that I might make it number two.
Nice.
Okay.
Because I love The New World more than I love There Will Be Blood, but if, like, I have to stick with what they're talking about, then, you know, I might have to be real with it. So let's talk some other stuff. First of all, Michael Haneke isn't on this list, which I don't know
why.
But it rubs. Cachet is not on this list, is it?
No, that's what I'm saying. Cachet
should be on this list like a motherfucker. Or if that's too weird for you, you could go for The White Ribbon. But like, or Amour. Literally anything he's ever made that was made in the 21st century could be on this list. But I think that Cachet fits what they're saying the best. I think that
there are some notable exceptions as far as directors, for sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
Now, Pixar. I feel like WALL-E is better than Inside Out.
I happily agree with you. Mm-hmm. I do think though that Inside Out is revolutionary in kind of what it's attempting to do and things like that. Mm-hmm. But I do think, WALL-E was a complete and utter revelation for me. It is a children's film that starts with 20 minutes of no dialogue whatsoever.
Sure.
Like go ahead. Like just make a Disney film that has 20 minutes of no dialogue in the opening act and just see what you get. Like, go ahead, run with that idea and see what kind of movie you end up with. The fact that they made a love story about two robots is just remarkable. That film is amazing, so good. I'll go to bat for WALL-E any day of the week. And then behind that, it's got to be The Incredibles. Like, come on.
No. I agree.
I'm going to be the dick and say that I think first Mars. 50 minutes of WALL-E is perfect. I think that it goes on the spaceship. Oh, it gets a lot more sluggish and sloppy. I just rewatched it in the last three months. back the fuck off.
I feel like I'd have to check with my wife on this, but I feel like we just watched WALL-E fairly recently. And
it's a good movie, but it gets like that second half is not nearly as tight as the first 50 minutes.
Sure.
Yeah,
sure.
Because it has to.
But that, you know, that first 50 minutes is all time great. Like,
we came
sure,
here
fantastic.
Not to fight about WALL-E, but to fight about other things. I think the Coen brothers, No Country for Old Men over Inside Llewyn Davis.
Yeah,
I'm
really, really surprised that none of y'all picked Inside Llewyn Davis. I was going to choose that one, and then I was like, no, someone else is going to pick that. Actually, I don't even know why I did that, because I guess I just wanted to rant about a 40-year-old virgin. But yeah, Inside Llewyn Davis is a very, very odd pick. I do not think that film is going to stick around very much.
I get the sense you didn't like it very much then, Bill.
I mean, I actually liked it more than a lot of people at the time. Critically, it was kind of shrugged off, and especially theatrically. I mean, that movie landed like a wet fart. But you know, it's okay. It's good. It's good. It's just, man, is it fucking depressing. So, you know.
All right. Any other ones that we were like any ones that came close to the axe for any of you? I nearly took out Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind because
no, really,
I'm just fucking tired of that movie, man.
I understand that film is now has the backlash kind of coming back, you know, full circle around because it's like, oh, it's not perfect and it's not a masterpiece, sure. But it's like, yeah, that movie's actually really good though. Like it really is. So I don't mind it too much because I'm just like, yeah, that's great. That's awesome. I'm never going to watch it again, but you know,
mm-hmm. Yeah, but I feel like that says a lot that you aren't going to watch it again.
Yeah.
Like I guess rewatchability is a weird factor, you know, like, this is getting in some real dumb pedantic shit, but I'll say it anyway. Like if we were talking about the best films, but we weren't talking about the word classic, I wouldn't even think about the word rewatchability.
Yeah.
But when you say classics, I do start thinking about that. And that does make a few of these a little bit weirder.
Yeah.
Like something like, I have to say, like, I will go to bat to Kelly Reichardt for pretty much any movie this century, except for maybe Night Moves. And Wendy and Lucy is just an odd choice as it's a movie that's like a fantastic, you know, character piece. But they're as far as even other like Reichert films, like something like Meek's Cut Off or even Certain Women, like it's not something that's going to have lasting appeal. Like it is something that is very much dissected within this is Reichert's milieu and this is Michelle Williams' like fantastic performance. Like it's something that can't really exist in a vacuum in a very easy way. And I think there's quite a few of those that you could bring up the same argument for.
I agree.
As far as things that are missing from this list though, do we want to move on to that or did you have another one, Brian?
Oh, I was going to wrap us up really. And just my last like firm statement would be, a little surprised about the Hurt Locker, but you got to have Iraq, you know?
I would have done Zero Dark, but I know that's definitely more divisive.
I think Zero Dark is actually a better film in many ways, and I think it's more interesting in what it says about our culture and our ability to basically take a story and within a year produce a movie about it, which is still completely and utterly under wraps as far as like the information. And, you know, it gets into kind of the details of like how much access they were actually given, Mark Boal and stuff like that.
Rewatchability, like, though, you know, like
I think it's supremely rewatchable.
Sam,
you got more time on your hands than I do, sir.
I love that storyline. So,
I think the other thing about Zero Dark that's so interesting is, you know, I can't remember it might have been Naomi Scott actually who called it a Rorschach test for partisanship, in that like two people on opposite ends of the aisle can watch Zero Dark 30 and see their beliefs being supported. Like, it's fascinating.
Either supported or torn down, because there are people who are like, that movie glorifies torture. And then the people who are like, no, that movie says that torture is wrong. And then if you put that thought into the brain of anyone on either side of the aisle, it's a toss-up as to whether or not they're going to be happy with that thought or angry with it.
Sure. But that's fascinating in itself. Like, yes. You can't say that about that many movies.
Yeah. I got three other three films I want to mention briefly.
You have 1 minute to go through all of them. We are at an hour.
Yeah, I know. The one that is obviously missing from this and actually the BBC list that I'm surprised about is got to be The Dark Knight. I don't think we can make a classics of the future list and not have a superhero film on this list. I think that's completely absurd, because if anything, this last decade or so has been defined by, it is superhero films. Love it or hate it, that is what this entire last decade has been basically focused on. And the one that really kind of kickstarted all of that is The Dark Knight. Now, that one came out 2 years after Casino Royale, which is why I was kind of trying to chomp at the bit for anybody that's like, you chose Casino over The Dark Knight? Yes, because I think it came out earlier, and I think it did a better job of kind of cementing that seed and basically allowing The Dark Knight and all of these other reboots and all these other crazy fucking things that have happened to happen. And I think, honestly, Heath Ledger's performance in that is going to be all-time classic, and so that film is always going to be brought up as far as acting and things like that is concerned. The other two films, I got to go to bat for Pan's Labyrinth. I'm surprised it didn't make this list. And then if we want to talk about a little bit more action stuff, The Bourne Supremacy. I'm choosing that because that's the film that really kind of started the handheld genre in many ways. It started its own franchise, and, you know, it kickstarted Matt Damon as a action star, which is, you know, odd. That film in many ways kickstarted a lot of things. Now, it is
a lot of
definitely
bad things.
A lot of bad things. It is definitely not one of my favorite films. It is definitely not a very rewatchable film necessarily. I think Ultimatum is hands down way above a better film, but you know, if you want to talk about classics that had a huge influence, especially on actions cinema from this point forward, I think Bourne Supremacy definitely belongs on this list in many ways.
All right. Michael Snydell, any final thoughts before we wrap up?
A few that we didn't mention. I think there'd be a pretty good argument for something like Jackass. And yep.
Okay, we're done here, you asshole.
Do you hate Jackass, friend?
The fucking Johnny Knoxville.
Yeah.
Oh,
you're
gonna get rid of Boyhood. You're gonna you know
what? I will Jackass 100 times over Boyhood.
I just want the people at home to know. Michael is not a troll. He earnestly holds these beliefs, and we don't just keep him here to make you mad. We respect his opinion, but what the fuck?
I think there is something to be said, like, along the same way that we've been talking about 40-Year-Old Virgin, I think there is something to be said about, like, the rise of trolling and this, like, combination of low and high art. And I think Jackass is one of the best, like, is emblematic of that in really good ways. It's a fantastically edited movie. And if you are into raunchy humor, it is Spike Jones. And if you are into raunchy humor, there are few better examples of it in the 21st century.
All right. What's your other choice?
Other things is The 25th Hour by Spike Lee.
Okay, acceptable. next one.
Magic Mike XXL, which I think is the musical the 21st century.
I think that I understand the love for Magic Mike. I don't know about Magic Mike XXL. I've got to watch them again back to back.
I've seen it about 10 times now, and it's one of the most joyful.
Is it really that much better than Magic Mike?
It is the tonal opposite. It really is. Right. So I mean, if you
XXL
know,
is not Soderbergh, right?
No,
it is his main DP, Gregory Jacobs.
I thought Soderbergh is his own fucking DP.
Doesn't he have like 40 pseudonyms?
He does have 40 yeah. pseudonyms, but no, this is actually a different person than Soderbergh.
All right.
Okay.
Well, that's the end of the show. This is, you know what? I don't even know what to say right now. It's the end of the show.
Separation.
Let's.
You broke Brian, Michael.
I wish I'd said triple nine.
You can put that as the full quote for the show. Do it. I'm fine with that.
Okay, so that's the end. A reminder to everyone out there that if you would like to help us do more and sound better, you can become a patron of this show at patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. For as little as $1 an episode, you can help us to get better equipment and do more shows. When we reach $50 an episode, I will get a throat lozenge so that I can stop clearing my throat on this podcast. We will also be doing classic movie discussions. We have more things on from there when we reach $100.
Like non-movie conversations. So if you want to hear a whole hour of us eating, you could do so.
Oh my God. I would love to do like one episode where we're just like each get a meal from a restaurant and like do like the Doughboys. But so for instance, $100, we will do listener suggested movie discussions. So all the Madea films basically. And then $150, we will record a full commentary, which I like, you know, money aside, I would love to do that.
Sure.
So please give us enough money that we can do that. That is that. So again, patreon.com/thefilmstageshow. Any contribution that you can give is greatly appreciated. You will also get access to the special Slack channel where you can talk to us, and you have the opportunity to win one of Jordan Rapp's Criterion Blu-rays. This week's Blu-ray is Rumblefish. So remember that the earlier you sign up, the less people you will have to contend with over Jordan Rapp's collection of Criterion Blu-rays. Again, that is Rumblefish, directed by Francis Ford Coppola. And we're also brought to you by Mubi. Mubi, the streaming online cinema, where instead of just throwing down a bunch of shit into the slop bucket and hoping you eat it up like Netflix does, Mubi has curators who actually select movies based on quality and content, much like they would do if they were trying to create a list for the New York Times. And you can watch those movies for free on us for 30 days. Every movie exists on Mubi for 30 days, so you'll have the lifespan of a single movie to watch as many movies as you like. All you have to do is go to mubi.com/filmstage, and you can get 30 days on us. Again, that's mubi.com/filmstage. That is all for today. If you have any ideas for what you'd like us to talk about in the future, I know we've been getting a couple of those on the social media.
I hope we have to do a Jackass commentary.
All right, fine, fuck it. I was going to say some stuff, but now I'm not. Bill Graham, where can we find you between now and next time?
You can find me reading the BBC list over and over, which I much prefer, on Twitter at CableBFG. You can definitely find me on the Slack channel, where I will be talking a little bit more than I do on Twitter. Sorry about that, y'all. And you can find me writing about movies on The Film Stage and FreshFiction.tv.
All right, Michael Snydell.
You can find me hate reading reviews of The Book of Henry, which comes out this week. And you can read my writing at The Film Stage. And I do movie logs on Letterboxd.
All right. And you can find me on Twitter wondering why we're not doing The Book of Henry for our next movie review podcast at Brian J.
We are. We are.
Yeah, but Mike doesn't want to do it. Anyway.
I'm out.
That's all right.
Brian J. Rowan. On Twitter, on Letterboxd, on Instagram, on everything. I have no imagination when it comes to picking out a screen name. You can also find my writing on filmstage.com and my personal site, dearfilm.net. So that is about that. So ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much, and join us this coming week when we'll be talking about The Girl with All the Gifts and possibly another movie as well. So thank you again, and tune in next time.